Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Republicans are defending 23 U.S. Senate seats this year. If they lose 9, Senate Democrats will have a filibuster-proof majority of 60 seats for the first time since 1978. It's a long shot, but there's a lot in play in the Senate and around the country on November 4th. This hour, On Point, we'll go to hot Senate races across the country in North Carolina, New Hampshire, Minnesota, and Oregon, from Al Franken to Liddy Dole, to ask what's coming on Capitol Hill. We'll check in on key Senate races throughout this hour. Joining me first from Washington is Carl Hulse, chief congressional correspondent for the New York Times. He's been reporting on Congress for 20 years now. Carl, great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. So let's look at the Senate. How much are the Democrats thinking they've got pretty well in their sights at this late hour before the election? And what are the odds of the big dream for Democrats anyway, a supermajority, 60 seats?
The Democrats are obviously feeling pretty good about where they are right now with a little over 2 weeks to go. I think it's almost inevitable that they're going to pick up 4 or 5 seats at this point, and the question becomes how many more can they get, and can they hit the sort of magic 60 number? It's within reach, and people even 6 months ago didn't think that was possible, but the economic turmoil has really changed the landscape out there. And I was in Kentucky over the weekend covering Mitch McConnell's race, and no one really thought Mitch McConnell would have a race, and he's in a tough race right now.
Just let's take a look at that one. We're not touching down in Kentucky, but Mitch McConnell, of course, right at the top of the heap for Republicans in the Senate. Who's challenging him? What's made him vulnerable there?
Well, it's Bruce Lunsford, who is a businessman who's run a couple of other times in Kentucky. They've got some very tough ads on one another. And it's just the economy. I mean, people are scared out there about their jobs. That's what you hear when you walk around at some of these campaign events and talk to people. I think the Republicans in the Senate have also been hurt somewhat this cycle by the fact that the sort of cultural issues that normally help them, you know, gun control, gay rights, those sort of things, they're just not that prominent out there.
Carl, take us through the different tiers here. First, the Senate races, the states in which Republicans at this point appear most likely to lose. And then what's the second tier of races that Democrats have their sights on, which may still be toss-ups?
Well, I think everyone virtually gives the Democrats Virginia, where the former governor, Mark Warner, is running. And I saw a poll at one point where he was 30 points ahead. I think New Mexico is generally, you know, all these races have yet to be run, and I don't like to be too predictive, obviously, but these are the way analysts are talking about it. New Mexico would be another one. New Hampshire, which you're going to talk about, it's generally, you know, people say that they think the Democrat should win there. John Sununu's a tough candidate. The polls have swung around there. I don't know. Colorado is another race. Sort of in that first tier, I would say, where people think that Democrats are strongest. Then you move to Minnesota, Oregon, North Carolina races where there's some, you know, strong incumbents in those races. The other races are sort of open seats. And then if they can, then Alaska, which is its own race entirely, where Senator Stevens is on trial, and I think closing arguments are coming early this week. And, you know, if he can get an acquittal, you know, that could change the whole complexion of that race. And then you sort of get into these other races, which are the bonus races or the ones that the Democrats would need to surprise people in. Kentucky, Georgia, Mississippi, and even Maine, you know, that's how they can get to 60. So that's sort of the way it's shaping up here, at least the way people are looking at it. Anything can happen. The Democrats, Mary Landrieu in Louisiana is considered their most endangered candidate. There was sort of some back and forth last week as to whether Republicans were pulling off their ads there. I think they put some back on this week. So that's sort of the toughest Democratic race.
The economy, a huge driver here, and of course the presidential race as well. Big developments in that over the weekend. Here's former Secretary of State, retired General Colin Powell, Republican, announcing on Meet the Press yesterday that he's for Barack Obama.
I have watched an individual who has intellectual vigor, and who dives deeply into issues and approaches issues with a very, very steady hand. And so I'm confident that he'll be ready to take on these challenges on January 21st.
Carl Hulse with the New York Times on Capitol Hill. What do you make of the Powell endorsement and the presidential race in general? Is it pulling these candidates up or down, or is it bigger issues even than the candidates, the economy number one?
Well, I think the Powell endorsement, I think it's a major development. What struck me was when Roy Blunt yesterday on one of the TV talk shows, he's the number two Republican in the House, said, boy, I wish he would have endorsed John McCain. He recognizes the power of this. I think it helps with independents and moderate Republicans. It sort of gives a stamp of approval on national security to Senator Obama. And the presidential race is big in these races, but it plays in different ways, you know, and I'm sure you'll talk about it in say, Oregon. But the thing that's driving a lot of Democratic optimism here is the voter registration increase in some of these states that Democrats have engineered. And in North Carolina, there was a very big increase in voter registration among African Americans. I think since the beginning of the year, somewhere in the neighborhood of 150,000, 160,000 new African American voters there. And that's if new voters come out to vote in some of these races, that's where Democrats think they can get a wave going.
Let's jump right out to one of those states. You mentioned North Carolina. Here's an ad launched in August by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, taking a kind of lighthearted swap at Elizabeth Dole, the incumbent, at her effectiveness in office. It shows, the TV ad shows two seniors in rocking chairs asking what happened to the Liddy Dole they knew.
I'm telling you, Liddy Dole is 93.
93?
Yep. She ranks 93rd in effectiveness.
After 40 years in Washington?
After 40 years in Washington, Dole is 93rd in effectiveness, right near the bottom.
I've read she's 92.
Did I just tell you she's 93?
No, 92% of the time she votes with Bush.
What's happened to the Liddy Dole I knew?
She's just not a go-getter like you and me.
Now, for the record, Elizabeth Dole is 72 in age. But let's hear what's going on in North Carolina. From Charlotte, North Carolina, we're joined by Jim Morrill, senior political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Hi, Jim. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. How are you?
I'm well. What do the polls show right now in this race?
Well, it depends which polls you look at. Most polls show a very close race, and some even give a slight edge to the Democrat Kay Hagan over Elizabeth Dole. I think any of the polls suggest that Ms. Dole has a tough race.
Tell us about Kay Hagan. Who is she? How did she come to challenge? Elizabeth Dole's a big name.
Well, she is a big name. She's such a big name that about a year ago, there were no big Democrats that wanted to run against her. I mean, she looked pretty tough. It was a different landscape back then. Governor Easley, the outgoing Democratic governor, passed up a chance to run against her. And finally, the Democrats settled on Kay Hagan, who's a state senator from Greensboro, who's been there for 10 years, very energetic, pretty accomplished in Raleigh, but pretty unknown outside her home territory.
And how do you figure what's driving the dynamic foremost here, Jim? Is it voter registration? Carl Hulse just talked about the big wave there in North Carolina. Is it the economy? Is it the candidates at the top of the ticket, Obama and McCain?
I think it's all of that. I think it's certainly the economy, and it's certainly not a good year to run as a Republican, even in North Carolina. Senator Hagan's made a big deal out of tying Mrs. Dole to Bush. You know, her voting record has been pretty consistently in support of the president until relatively recently. So, you know, there's that. There's sort of this wave of, anti-incumbency and anti-Washington, and you see that in the voter registration numbers. We've had over 700,000 new voters register this year, and Democrats had the advantage in the number of new voters, and African Americans, as Carl said, too. So those are both, those are probably both going Senator Hagan's way.
Here's a Dole campaign ad called ARF hitting back at Kay Hagan. It shows a small dog named Fibber Kay yapping against a white picket fence.
They call her Fibber Kay Hagan. Fib after fib, she tries to turn us against Elizabeth Dole. But we know Elizabeth has been consistently voted one of the 10 most admired women in the world. Her clout works wonders for North Carolina. So bark away, Fibber Kay. That dog don't hunt.
Elizabeth Dole goes after challenger Kay Hagan there. Jim, how do you read it? Do you think the Senate outcome in North Carolina depends on who takes the state in the presidential sweepstakes there?
Well, I don't know if it depends on who takes the state, but there's certainly a lot of, I think Senator Hagan's got the wind to her back in the sense that there's a lot of new registrants out here that we talked about, and a lot of people, Obama's getting a lot of people out here. I mean, he had 10,000 people this weekend in Fayetteville, which is not the most Democratic part of the state, not the most liberal Democratic part of the state by any means. And so he's getting a lot of people excited here, and he's going to have a big turnout. Whether it's enough to push him over the top or not is unclear, but it would certainly help people like Senator Hagan.
And Elizabeth Dole, on the home stretch here, what's she saying? What's she telling North Carolinians?
Well, she's trying to stick up for her effectiveness. She's talking about having opposed or brought up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac years ago and fighting to regulate them a little bit more, and without much success up there because her bills weren't passed, or the bills that she supported weren't passed. And she's also raising questions about Kay Hagan, who did not take a stand right away on the bailout bill and sort of waited until that had already passed to come out against it.
Just one of the races that could go either way could be part of a supermajority for the Democrats emerging on Capitol Hill. Jim Morrill with the Charlotte Observer in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jim, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's go to Georgia, Savannah, Georgia, and Michael. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling. We have a real tight race here between Jim Martin and Saxby Chambliss, and I've noticed in their ads that they all seem to mirror the national campaign. It seems like they're getting a lot of. I don't know. I'm wondering if in the other campaigns, if the national campaigns are trying to pull their votes that way. Georgia really seems solidly McCain right now, but it's tight, and I'm obviously Barack Obama supporter, and I'm outnumbered here. But it just seems that Martin's able to pull away, and it seems that a lot of the national media is really the national campaigns have put a lot of stock into Saxby Chambliss. I just didn't know if that was true in any of the other races.
Michael, let us look at it with Carl Hulse. Carl, of course, is Saxby Chambliss famous for taking out Max Cleland 6 years ago in a very tough race there, where he went after triple amputee war hero Cleland 2002. And a lot of bitterness remaining about that. And now Chambliss himself, the latest poll I'm seeing is he's up, but it's only by a couple of points, two or three. What do you hear out of Georgia, Carl?
Well, it's obviously a tighter race than they anticipated there. I think that Senator Chambliss was really nervous about his vote for the $700 billion bailout, went back home immediately, put on a TV ad explaining his vote. The Democrats obviously would love to knock him off in revenge for the Max Cleland race. There's no question about it. The last, most recent I've heard on that race is that the Democrat, though he's done pretty well raising money, might not have a lot of money of his own right now to sort of close this out in the final weeks with TV ads. And it'll be a question of, whether the Democratic Party will go in there and put a lot of money in there. I think Senator Obama's campaign has sort of been in and out of Georgia. Mm-hmm. Definitely a competitive state, definitely another state where big African-American turnout could produce a surprise.
Let's get a call from Boston and Michael there. Michael in Boston, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm concerned that we may be fetishizing the number 60. Mm. There's still a few moderate Republicans, and there are quite a few conservative Democrats. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering to what extent that bill-by-bill coalitions can be built that would get above 60.
That's a very interesting question. Carl, how about it? How big? I mean, just in terms of gains, it would be a huge gain to get to 60. But if the Democrats got there, how significant for changes in policy?
Well, that caller really has something. It's sort of a dirty little secret here in Washington that there's Democrats who are concerned about hitting 60, honestly. They want all the votes they can get. But 60, the filibuster-proof idea, could raise expectations so high that now that Democrats have 60, they're going to be able to, you know, have their way in the Senate. And that is just not going to happen. There's a lot of different coalitions that exist there. Some of the disagreements among Democrats themselves have been covered up in the past few years by Republican opposition. Democrats have found it easy to vote for bills that they knew were not going to clear the 60 vote threshold. So I think that there is a fear that that Democrats could people could get so excited about this and then not see the achievements. And then you have Joe Lieberman, right? He's could be one of the 60 if they're at 60, and I'm not sure that people know where his politics are going to be after the election.
Yeah, the conservative editorial page of the Wall Street Journal late last week warning, you know, hey, it's going to be a whole new America if the Democrats get a supermajority, Medicare for all, union supremacy, completely different business climate, taxes turned upside down, and they're warning against, of course, their conservative green revolution excesses. But you're saying, Carl, you don't necessarily see a tsunami policy shift if Dems hit that number.
Well, I think it's not a sure thing. I do think there would obviously be major changes in policy. There's some leftover Democratic initiatives that they would want to get through. The children's health insurance bill that got stalled, I think that would be one of the first ones out of the chute. They want to do a lot of public works projects. But, you know, Democrats tend to fight amongst themselves when they get control. And I think that it'd be a learning experience for them.
Let's go to Minnesota, where former comedian Al Franken has been hot on the trail of incumbent Republican Norm Coleman. Patricia Lopez joins us from the Minneapolis Star Tribune in St. Paul, Minnesota. Patricia, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
How goes the Franken-Coleman race? What do the polls show?
Well, it shows that so far they're still locked in a statistical dead heat. It's been the same kind of roller coaster that we've seen on the presidential level. One poll will show Coleman up, the other one will show Franken up, and right now we've got them pretty much dead even with a third-party wildcard candidate, Dean Barkley from the Independence Party, who's pulling roughly 18%.
18%, so then pretty much even. Let's listen to just a little bit of them going back and forth. This is in Duluth last Thursday in a Senate debate in Minnesota. Coleman called himself a doer. Franken said he was a friend of the middle class. Here's Norm Coleman, Republican, first.
You were against the energy bill. You were against the stimulus. This isn't about what you're against. We have real problems out there, real challenges. And in the end, it's about who can work and actually try to solve it. And that's what I've done, and that's what those votes represent.
You know, we've heard a lot from Senator Coleman about it's not enough to talk, and you have to take action. This is about who you take, on whose behalf you take action. I'm going to take action on behalf of the families in Minnesota. I'm not going to take action on behalf of the drug companies. I'm not going to take action on behalf of the insurance companies.
Former comedian Al Franken going nose-to-nose there with Republican Norm Coleman in Minnesota. Patricia Lopez, what about Franken's evolution from comic to serious candidate? We know Minnesotans are broad-minded. They put Jesse Ventura in office. But how's he made that with the Minnesota electorate? How's that gone?
Well, it's been difficult. I think he has done all of the things he's supposed to do. He built a political organization from scratch. He was in the state for a couple of years solidly. He campaigned for other legislators in the 2006 election cycle, and so built himself up as a presence, and I think that helped against charges that he was just sort of, you know, high buck carpetbagger, had flown in just to buy off a Senate seat. He had just logged too much time in the state for that to really stick. And he has remained very serious. It's difficult to get a wisecracker, an actual joke out of Al Franken on this Senate race. And I think he's realized that he needs to project himself as a serious policy-minded candidate, but you know he's got his entire past that he drags around with him. So some people react to the version that he is now, and some people are still thinking of things that he's written, skits he did on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
you know, bits and pieces floating around from 35 years in comedy.
He must be biting his tongue a lot. How does the Senate race...
you can see it's a little difficult sometimes.
Right. I mean, that's just what comes naturally, but still, mm-hmm. he's making a transition, I guess. What about the presidential race and the Senate race? How do they interweave in Minnesota? Who's up in the presidential race now there, and do these two tend to move in lockstep in the polls?
No, actually, that's not the case. You know, Barack Obama has a very solid lead in Minnesota right now. He had lost it for a while during the summer, but throughout this time, there's been a substantial gap between where he is and where Franken is. And this is a state notorious for ticket splitting. So you've got lots of people who are happy to vote one way at the top of the ticket for the presidential race, and then they'll go and vote on the other side for the Senate race, and then back again for their congressional races. I was talking to some people like that over the weekend, and they'll go based on various things. One gentleman I talked to said it was whoever seemed to him to be the most sincere, and it didn't matter which party that was.
And how does Norm Coleman talk about John McCain, or does he, Patricia?
Well, he doesn't talk about him very much. He did have an appearance in northern Minnesota with Todd Palin. That surprised some people.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, he has not linked himself to McCain very strongly. You can't get a real sense of where he is on McCain's health care policy, economic policies. He pretty much sticks to the line that he's running his own race, which is generally candidates do when they don't want to get too close to the other fellow. There has been an acknowledgement from Coleman that the economic problems have just rewritten the Senate race in the last 2 weeks.
Franken up a couple of points here in the latest Real Clear Politics poll summary that I'm mm-hmm. looking at here. Patricia Lopez in St. Paul, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's get a call from Toledo, Ohio. And Chris, hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Great show. Thanks very much.
Sure.
And I want to talk about, you know, Ohio is obviously a big battleground state. I'm in the northwest part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, I realize that they break these poll numbers into states, but it seems like, to me at least, in a lot of these states, it's a regional thing. You know, like in northwest Ohio, it's highly Democratic, but you go towards places like Dayton or Cincinnati, and you get more of a Republican base, I guess, or a conservative base. Like, for example, the 9th Congressional District, Marcy Kaptur, who's a Democrat, is very popular up here, and I would suspect, I haven't seen a lot of polls on her, but I suspect that she's going to have an easy victory. I just wondered what the regional aspect of this election, even within states, you know, how that's measured and that sort of thing.
Yeah, Chris,
it's very tight.
Yeah, it's going to be key, obviously. You're in the Northwest, maybe leaning Democrat, but it goes southeast in Ohio, and you've got a very different picture. Carl Halsey, even getting to the state level, is not deep enough here. Chris is exactly right. States very different within their borders.
Yeah, certainly. In fact, it was very noticeable when I was in Kentucky over the weekend. The Democrat was campaigning east of Louisville and the Republican campaigning west. So naturally, people go to where their strengths are. Ohio this year, in terms of Congress, is very important as House races. There's a lot of important House races there, and it's just very diverse. And people are trying to, I think, the presidential campaigns and the Senate campaigns, they're all concentrating on trying to turn out their strength. In following Senator Dole's race recently, I noticed a lot of her events are outside, you know, the major urban areas, mm-hmm. Sort of more rural where her people are, and Senator Hagan doing more in Charlotte and Greensboro, where she's from. So people would definitely go where they think their votes are.
Chris, thanks for your call from Toledo. Let's check in with New Hampshire, where there's a big race on right now. In this last couple of weeks to November 4th, we're joined from Nashua, New Hampshire, in the Nashua Telegraph by Kevin Landrigan. He's political reporter there, senior political reporter. Kevin, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be on, Tom.
You've got Gene Shaheen, Democrat, and John Sununu, Republican incumbent. What are the polls showing, Kevin?
Right now, the polls show Gene Shaheen with a solid lead, but not an insurmountable one, certainly. Certainly in the last couple of weeks, she's begun to open up a bit of a lead, but as I say, it's not an insurmountable one. It's just outside the margin of error. She's been helped, I think, by the growing strength of Barack Obama in the state. His lead here has opened up a bit, and I think that's helped her somewhat. This is a This is a rematch from 2002, so it's got a lot of interest here, and it's going to be by far the most expensive election in New Hampshire history. With the third-party groups added to it, it could be as much as $40 million expensive.
Wow. Let's listen in just a little bit. October 6th debate at St. Anselm College. Here's Republican incumbent John Sununu accusing the Democratic challenger, Jeanne Shaheen, of being wishy-washy on the bailout bill.
And you've got to provide leadership on issues like this. What Governor Shaheen initially said was that she would probably make a decision about whether she'd support the bill when it came before the Senate. Then she told the Conway Sun she was inclined to support it. Then that same day, she said she would probably vote against it. That's not leadership.
The Conway Sun's moment in the sun there. Jeanne Shaheen shot back with a critique of John Sununu's priorities. She said he puts ambition before public interest.
John, I don't need a lecture about leadership. If I had been in the United States Senate, what I would have done instead of coming up here to campaign on Tuesday and Wednesday of last week, I would have stayed in Washington and I would have worked on that bill so that we could assure taxpayers that they're getting the same guarantee that Wall Street is being given in this legislation. And right now, they don't have that kind of guarantee.
Jeanne Shaheen and John Sununu battling it out for the Senate seat in New Hampshire. Kevin Landrigan, let me put the same question to you about how this sort of interweaves with the polling on the presidential front. Where do the presidential candidates stand in New Hampshire now, and how closely does that mirror where the Senate candidates stand?
Yeah, it's interesting, Tom. John McCain, of course, in New Hampshire has won here two presidential primary victories, including one in 2000 against now President George W. Bush. So he's a very popular candidate here, and we've always thought he would run strong. But as we know, it's not a Republican year. This electorate is extremely in opposition to the Iraq War, and I think to some degree that has hurt him, and certainly the economy has as well. There isn't any question that John McCain's the only Republican who could conceivably win New Hampshire this year, and he still could. But Barack Obama holds a slight lead. You may recall in January he lost the primary here to Hillary Rodham Clinton, the New York senator, by 3%. And he really lost it in the last week. That's one of the reasons why he came here last week to campaign. And essentially his message was pretty forceful. We're not taking anything for granted. We're not going to lie down. And we're not going to try and coast. And in many ways, he tried to do that in the primary. After a strong win in Iowa, the campaign held big rallies where the candidate didn't take any questions. Hillary Rodham Clinton had events taking questions for hours and hours. And at the end of the day, she was able to pull that one out. He's determined to not let that happen to him. There is some parallel in this race. As in Minnesota, voters here do like the ticket split. We also have a large independent electorate that's almost 40% of the vote. It's by far the biggest group, and they're the most important group, certainly, and John McCain has done well with them in the past. John Sununu is trying to kind of not run on McCain's coattails, but certainly be helped by his popularity. Sununu's at every event that more than 20 people gather that involves the McCain campaign, And I think that has helped him build support, particularly among independents, which he's going to need to have.
Kevin Landrigan with the Nashua Telegraph on the front lines there in Nashua, New Hampshire, where Jeanne Shaheen at this point leads incumbent Republican John Sununu. Kevin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Checking in around the country in North Carolina, New Hampshire, and Minnesota. We've been joined by Carl Hulse, chief congressional correspondent for the New York Times, with us from Washington. We'll go to Oregon in just a moment, but let's get a call from Charleston, South Carolina, and Jason. Jason, you're on the air. Hi, Jason. What do you think?
I'm voicing my opinion that I think is pretty common among conservatives.
Jason, we're having trouble picking up your phone, and I'm sorry for that. Let's try another here from New Orleans in Louisiana. Mark is calling. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about a race that's going on here between Mary Landrieu, the incumbent, and she has a Republican contender,
yeah.
Kennedy. And their Republican Party recently just pulled out within the past week or two, the National Party pulled out support. And due to, I think, a lot of the shifting of the demographics of people due to Katrina, it's the Republicans, I think, had an idea that they could come in and take over Mary Landrieu's seat.
Well, there was, for a time, the sort of word on the street that Mary Landrieu was the Democratic incumbent who was vulnerable. You're saying it doesn't look that way now, Mark?
Right, yeah, yeah. So in the past week or two, the National Party has pulled out monetary support for advertisements.
Huh. I don't know the exact news, but let us pick it up. Carl Hulse, what about Mary Landrieu in the Louisiana picture for the Senate race?
Well, she was obviously always rated the Democrat most threatened, for a lot of reasons. One, because it's still uncertain a bit who the electorate is in Louisiana.
To Mark's point, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's been some conflicting reports on whether the National Party is going to spend money on ads down there. They did pull out last week. I think there was some pressure to go back in. The last I had heard was that they were going to possibly buy some ads again this week and then reassess and see if they would spend money again next week or needed to go somewhere more urgent. I think that the Republican candidate, who was heavily recruited for the race, mm-hmm. by the party, I think that he just has not quite caught on to the degree that they thought. You know, Mary Landrieu's a tough campaigner. She really looks out for Louisiana. She, in terms of getting the money, she always sort of stages a end-of-session filibuster to try and get more disaster relief. She's mm-hmm. got a famous name down there. She's tough to beat.
Talk about getting the money. I mean, the anti-earmarks line has run into kind of right up against the need for incumbents to prove their worth. Mitch McConnell talking about how much bacon he can bring home to Kentucky, and that if he, with all his seniority, loses that seat, Kentucky wouldn't have access to that, is kind of awkwardly at odds with John McCain's let's cut those earmarks.
You know,
line.
It's totally at odds. When I was out there, and I actually haven't written my story that I will write out of the race out there, but that's what people were talking to me about, is that Mitch McConnell's got this for them or that for them. I think there's a real disconnect between the anti-earmark rhetoric that you hear in Washington and what people are looking for out there. Of course, they always think that other states' projects are unnecessary
for
it, right?
Of course.
But it is Mitch McConnell. It's the basis of his reelection campaign out there, and I don't think that he's going to have John McCain come in to talk about that we need to get rid of earmarks.
Let's get a call from Karen in East Sandwich, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am against a majority-proof filibuster, and I am an activist Democrat.
Well, what does that mean? You haven't drunk your own Kool-Aid.
Well, no, because I think that that it could come back to haunt us in 2012, and I think the only way that we're going to be able to work through this partisanship is by the spirit of bipartisanship. Now, I know I'm an East Coast liberal optimist, but I think it'll be a great referendum if we're able to, of course, get Obama elected, get a few more senators and congressmen, but not get a full majority.
But explain that a little more, Karen. If you're a Democrat and an activist, no less, and you believe in the Democratic agenda, why wouldn't you want a filibuster-proof majority that might make it more possible to push that through? Why not?
Because I think it'll hurt us in the long run.
How?
I think that we have to have, a measured amount of Republicans. We have to hear both sides of the picture. And I'm really worried that, 2012, people are going to turn around and it's going to go completely the opposite way. I think, again, we have to be able to come together on issues and work together without, having one party dominate.
Karen, thanks very much for your call. Carl, how about it? What do you hear among Democrats in Washington? Do they really want that supermajority, or is that almost more one way than they'd like at this point, or more responsibility than they might want, given the gigantic problems facing, both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue next January?
Well, as I said earlier, some people are nervous about it, but they want to get as many incumbents as they can. I think one thing we haven't talked about is that the Democrats are going to gain seats no matter who wins the presidency at this point. And Senator McCain, could still triumph. And then the Democrats, of course, would want the largest number they can if they have to deal with him. I think that there is a sense among Democrats, especially if Senator Obama wins, that 2010, not just 2012, could be a spark of backlash. You know, that's typical that the party that controls the White House, and say it is the Democrats, then loses seats in Congress. I think you'll hear after, you know, November 5th, Republicans immediately saying, well, we plan on getting all our seats back in 2010. But there's definitely some nervousness. And people, you know, there are people who make their electoral decisions very informed, where they want divided government. And
it's interesting
vote that way.
Even Karen, who's a Democratic activist, kind of wants the bipartisanship that might come with having to work together, with that being a requirement by the numbers. Let's move out to Oregon, Portland, Oregon, and Jeff Mapes. He's a senior political reporter for the Oregonian newspaper. Jeff, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
We're great. Tell us about your Senate contest out there. Gordon Smith, the Republican incumbent, and Jeff Merkley. What's it look like, Jeff?
Well, you know, it's one barn burner of a contest, I have to say. Actually, in recent polls, Jeff Merkley, the Democratic challenger, has had a lead of as much as 6 points, depending on which poll you look at. One poll did show him tied, but, you know, this is definitely a case where the incumbent is in real trouble, in part because there is such a Democratic surge in Oregon. Democratic registration is at something of a 20-year high, something like that. And, Barack Obama is running very strong in the state.
No, it's an interesting race, though, Jeff. I was just out there visiting family recently and down on the Rogue River there. Gordon Smith, a very moderate Republican. We sat down with him in St. Paul. I mean, this is anything but, a red meat Republican. And even so, he's in trouble.
Yes, and, you know, that's sort of one of the interesting battles in this race is the fight for the definition of Gordon Smith. He, of course, has been very much emphasizing that he is a moderate, that he's somebody who works across party aisles. In fact, he's received a lot of national attention for running ads that feature his work with Barack Obama, John Kerry, Ted Kennedy, And he's also very much emphasized his work with the state senior senator, Ron Wyden, a Democrat who's endorsed Jeff Merkley. They both have ads on the air right now talking, that feature Ron Wyden. So that's quite something. But on the other hand, Jeff Merkley has been emphasizing the idea that Smith may depart from his party on some occasions, essentially has been an enabler of the Bush agenda. And indeed, Smith has been a very strong supporter, for example, of the Bush tax cuts. And I think overall his voting record is he's sided with the president something like 80% of the time. And so the Democrats, not surprisingly, they are hitting on that again, again, and again.
Gordon Smith made his fortune in food processing. Here I've got an ad, a new one. This one financed by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, launched last Friday, targeting Gordon Smith around that business on the illegal immigration front.
Delicious peas from Smith Frozen Foods. Gordon Smith Frozen Foods. Where newspapers report there's ample evidence to suggest hiring illegal workers is a regular fact of life. Now Gordon Smith claims he wants to crack down on companies that hire illegal immigrants. But that's hard to believe. Because if you do that, who will package your peas then, Senator? Gordon Smith. What a hypocrite.
I don't know the story, Jeff Mapes. Is that fair?
Well, there has been an alternative newspaper in town that's written quite a few stories about the fact. They say that they found that there are some illegal immigrants that work there at the plant. Smith's company, he does not directly manage the company now, say that, they insist on proper documentation as far as they can tell. We had a story in our paper this week talking about how, sort of the processes they follow. Note that they do not have the e-verify system that the government now offers, where you can electronically check to see if somebody has proper documentation. So that's one issue on that.
And I've got an ad here where the Smith forces go after Merkley. What's Jeff Merkley's background, the challenger here?
Now, he Politically speaking, his background is that he's been in the state legislature since 1999. He is the Speaker of the House currently. He became the Speaker after the 2006 election when the Democrats took the state House from the Republicans here in Oregon. And it was very interesting. He, Merkley, presided over the House when, in the first time in years and years, that the Democrats had control of the virtually the entire process, and they only had majorities in both the House and Senate, and a Democratic governor. And so there was quite a flood of legislation produced from that, and that really has become his kind of the thing he talks a lot on the campaign trail in terms of his accomplishments. Now, he actually had a very tough primary against a rather colorful opponent, and a lot of people, I've noticed over the last several months, a lot of commentators, particularly at the national level, have, you know, said that he's not a particularly compelling or colorful candidate, but the guy, you know, and he's shown this through his political career, is very persistent, and you know, he's very much stuck to his message, you know, sort of his set of political messages, and you know, it's produced a very, very strong challenger. I should also mention there's one other factor in this race that's important, is there is one third party candidate on the ballot, a Constitution Party candidate, who really isn't, you know, running much of an active campaign, but some polls show him getting as much as 7 or 8% of the vote, and he may be a factor in causing problems for Gordon Smith.
A big bite. The latest I see in the polls, Merkley up 3+%, but who knows? Still a toss-up there. Let's hear just a little bit from, this is an ad launched by the National Republican Senatorial Committee, attack ad against Jeff Merkley. This one called Door, saying he's out of touch with rural Oregon.
Jeff Merkley's door is always open to Portland. But if you live in rural Oregon, Merkley will shut you out. The Office of Rural Policy closed with Merkley as Speaker. Merkley also voted against more water for farmers. He voted no on creating 4,000 new timber jobs. Merkley voted against the kicker tax refund, and he supported higher taxes 44 times. Jeff Merkley, when it comes to rural Oregon, he just doesn't get it.
There, as our Ohio caller had it earlier, that tension between urban and rural within Oregon in this case. Let's go to Joan in Northfield, Massachusetts. Joan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Joan?
I was had a comment. I was listening to your show while I was driving to Boston about the filibuster issue.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is key for this coming administration is, regardless of who even is in the Senate or the House, that the president stops writing signing statements that basically negate the laws that our elected officials are negotiating and passing in the Congress.
Joan, our time is short, but let me take it to Carl Hulse. Carl, there's been a lot of that under George W. Bush. Would a supermajority make a difference, or could a president go on writing signing statements and stepping right past legislation?
Well, I think that I noticed the president did a signing statement last week. I think the hope in Congress is that this will be a practice that's given up with the new president. But more numbers do give you the opportunity to go in and write the laws in a stronger fashion and prevent that. But it's still, that's probably more a legal and constitutional clash.
And Jeff Mapes in Oregon, what's your sense of Oregonians when it comes to this issue, whether they really want that big, big majority that could really turn the wheel on national policy, or they want something more bipartisan, you know, beyond Merkley and Gordon Smith? Do you feel a kind of a, you know, hey, let's really turn the page in a big way sentiment in Oregon, or something else?
You know, it's interesting. I was out just interviewing voters on the street last week, and this was in a suburban area where normally probably be pretty kind to Gordon Smith, and I was struck by how many voters, even Republicans, were who had said that they had once supported him, were now wavering, and they don't really talk about, well, we need a big majority in Congress or anything like that. They just said, well, I'm just so angry at George Bush, and I didn't sense that they were sort of carefully calculating this out of, oh, do we want to get to a filibuster-proof majority for the Democrats or what? but just that there was this real anger at the Bush administration, and that was spilling over into the Senate race.
Jeff Mapes with the Oregonian in Portland, Oregon, where even a very moderate Republican, Gordon Smith, in trouble in the polls right now. Jeff, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Carl Hulse, you've been a great guide in this hour. We've just got a few seconds left here. Republicans in Washington on Capitol Hill holding their head in their hands or still determined at this point? What's the sentiment you're here feeling?
Well, I think they're extremely nervous. They're very concerned. They see the reality of the situation. They may try and spin it, say it's not so bad. They're hoping the next 2 weeks turns things around a bit, but they know where this is headed, and they're just trying to hold off the losses. You know, just one last thing on Gordon Smith, kind of interesting. He's a cousin of Tom and Mark Udall, two Senate candidates probably favored right now in Colorado
right.
and New Mexico.
More and more there. Carl Hulse with the New York Times. We're out of time. Thanks for being with us, Carl. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.